Welcome, everyone. My name is Stephen Borg. I'm from a company called Northwest Cadence, where I'm the co-founder and strategist. And I've been lucky enough to work on dozens of process improvement projects in companies small and companies large. And one of the things I absolutely love is gathering metrics around those, understanding and proving the value of process improvement. So we've got a couple different reasons we gather metrics. The ones you'll see I'm biased towards are the ones that deal with process improvement that can help push us forward in terms of a company. So let's get started. By the way, I am really comfortable with people asking questions. I highly encourage you to interrupt. Shout out the questions if you want. Even if you're kind of quiet, you can come up here and there's mics. Feel free to come up and just ask any questions you like. This is my email address. Also, feel free to email me questions after the session. I'm flying home tonight, so I'll be I can just download my emails and hop on the plane and answer a bunch of them. And that's my Twitter tag if you want to, you know, fight over Twitter. Don't forget your evals. Speakers live and die by evals, so make sure you fill those out. I want to start with some poorly thought through metrics. Is it really echoey? Is that just me? Is it okay back there? Okay. Here's some poorly thought through metrics, and you probably have a million of your own, right, that you can give me examples of. But not catching your flight home. Let's talk about airlines in the U.S. There's the on-time departure metric. We're all familiar with that, right? What percentage of your flights left on time? And the FAA gathers that data and publishes it, and airlines use it as marketing. Where does that leave us? Often on the tarmac, right? They will pull off because as soon as they break away from the gate, that's their departure. Then you may sit on the tarmac for a while they wait for an actual runway that they can take off on. Well, that became problematic enough and then was kind of exacerbated by, was it JetBlue that had sat on the tarmac for 7 hours at one time? So now there's a new rule that if you sit on the tarmac for longer than X minutes or hours, you get dinged big time. It's a very large fine from the FAA in the amount of thousands of dollars per passenger on the flight. So now what we find is a spike in canceled flights. So you get on the flight, it looks like they may not make it out on time. So rather than try to pull out, get everyone on, and catch an open runway, they don't even try. They just cancel the flight because it's substantially cheaper. Metrics have consequences. Camping. If you were on a hiking trip in the 1970s in Russia, you probably had fairly heavy camping gear. Why? Because factories, their output was measured in tons. So they had to produce a certain number of tons of camping and hiking gear each quarter. Well, what's the easiest way? Make it big and make it heavy, right? Cast iron skillets for hiking. Horrible metric, right? Losing your phone connection to customer service. This is Amazon.com experimented with this. A lot of other places do the same. Customer service reps are metriced on how many phone calls they take. Well, what happens if you hang up on a phone call? You get more, right? You hang up, and that same person calls back, they count twice. It may not come to you, it comes to somebody, plus you're not wasting all of that time. That leaves unhappy customers, unsatisfied customers. But if you're bonused on that, it can come back and bite you. Let's flip it. Another call center, Gateway. They're bankrupt. They're not around anymore. They had a metric tagged onto theirs, which was, I thought, very interesting. It was if you were on the phone for longer than 13 minutes. It was just, there was no scaling. Just if you hit 13 minutes, you could not get a bonus that week, period. So what do you get? Hang-ups. Right? Kind of. What they found, however, that wasn't the behavior. This is tech support. So you pick up the phone, you called Gateway, and you're asking for tech support. You're not going to get there longer than 13 minutes, right? You're going to get hung up on. They're not going to make it past. But what tech support did is they just started saying, so tell me, how's it working? It doesn't seem to boot up. There's probably a problem. Send it back in. We'll send you a new one. They sent back, after the implementation of this, within a month, they were returning 7 times the number of equipment before. Because you weren't spending the time to troubleshoot. You were just sending people a new one. Right? Very interesting problems. And those are some poorly thought through metrics. Metrics have consequences, good and bad. So I really want to stress that before we get started. Yes. I'm going to have to hear this. And now I'm going to have to go dig up my sources.
So sort of in between that 13-hour talk time metric and bankruptcy was a new metric called first-time resolution. And the idea was that you got dinged on first-time resolution if someone else called about the same problem. And also it was a big deal to do a return. So it's interesting.
Excellent.
That
a new change.
That Gateways was kind of a death spiral of thrashing measurement. You would measure one thing, it would take us way to the right. We'd measure something else, and it would take us way to the left. So
that is really interesting. What was your name?
My name's Anthony.
Anthony, yes. Thank you so much for that. You don't get a treat like that often, right? The anecdotes, you just don't get to find someone from the company. You're the first person from Gateway. I love that. That's fantastic. Thank you, Anthony. Here's another quote. I'm not going to read it to you. But it's just a quote about software quality measures. Capers Jones is a guy who's done research on over 20,000 software development projects. And the success and failures, he's a huge metrics guy. If you're involved in metrics, you'll probably pick up one of his books at some point in time. This is on software quality. It's a harsh thing because some of us don't measure that. What we're going to talk about today, why metrics? Why measure them? We'll talk about just a couple reasons. A giant list of metrics. It's not a giant list, but it's about 3 pages. We're just going to kind of blow through a bunch of metrics to look at them. Then we're going to discuss the characteristic of what makes a good metric. And there's a lot of different ways to measure it. I'll give you my bias. Then we're going to go into an introduction to Kanban and Scrum. This presentation is not just metrics in general, although we cover that, but it's metrics specifically for agile and lean software development teams and what it means to transition into a lean software or an agile software development practice. There are some metrics for Scrum and Kanban. They tend to be far simpler than that first list, and we'll talk why. And then I'm going to make an assertion. I'll make it now. I'm going to assert that there is one metric that everyone should be looking at. The one metric to rule them all, if you will. It's not going to be the end-all, be-all of it's the only thing you have to measure. But I think it's one that I have become more and more convinced is absolutely critical and doesn't suffer from some of the negative side effects of other metrics. And we'll wrap up with a case study. Right, is this true? If you don't measure it, it doesn't get done? If you look up at these cliches, if you don't measure it, it's just a hobby. Are these true? I don't know. I've been persuaded that there are things that you can't really measure, at least numerically, that are very, very valuable. Esprit de corps, team cohesion, the effectiveness of your group at working together, kind of how you behave as a tribe. I think there's a lot of things that are difficult to measure, but are very, very important. The problem is that if you happen to be a manager, if you can't measure what you want, you end up wanting what you can measure. And that's the key why metrics are so critical. Why do you need to say something? Why do you need to show somebody a number or a range or an arrow going up or a green or a red or something? Is because what managers measure ends up being their focus, for good or for bad. Ray Lencioni just wrote a book called The Advantage, and in it, he says that the hardest thing is to create this esprit de corps inside your company, this cohesion, this culture, but that's the advantage a lot of companies get. If they can get that right, they'll blow everybody out of the water. But why don't managers do it? Because it's hard. It's very hard to measure. Here's an example. Utilization versus productivity, or capacity versus flow. It is really easy to measure utilization. I went to work, I arrived at 8, I left at 5, I took a 1-hour lunch break, I worked 8 hours, bang. I do that 5 hours a week, I have 100% utilization. Utilization, however, although it's easy to measure, is not necessarily an effective measure. What we care about is productivity. This is a snapshot out of my calendar from last year. This is at a lean conference. They should understand about capacity and buffers and some other things. If you look, it was crazy. There's a talk here called Keynote, Fundamental Secrets of the Universe. That keynote's going to run long. You know that keynote's going to run long. And it did. And everything got pushed. And notice, between talks, there was no break from a speaker to leave to the next speaker to come up. Not even a 15-minute break. So what happens when you wanted to change tracks? It was a mess. It was an absolute mess. People got less out of it because it was so packed. Utilization, this is a fully utilized freeway. 100% of that freeway is used. It's not an effective freeway, however. We don't care about utilization on freeways. We care about throughput. We care about flow. So if it's completely empty, it's not a very effective freeway either. It's a freeway to nowhere if no one ever's on it. So there's a balance somewhere between that. But it's flow we care about. I like this quote from Jim Benson. Capacity is how much stuff will fit. Throughput is how much stuff will flow, and they're not synonymous. This is my calendar. If you look later, that was May 4th. This is exactly 1 week later, and this is what my calendar looks like. If you look at my Outlook calendar, it looks something like this. There's gaps, and plenty of gaps between things I have to do. Those are sales calls. I run a small company. I'm on technical sales. There's a gap between each sales call. Why? It might run over, right? If it runs over, I don't want to throw away a sale simply by, oh, got to go and hang up so I can call the next person. That's crazy. But I don't want to be late either. So you put gaps in. It made me a more effective person. What did I do between the gaps if it ended on time? Did I just sit around? No. I had a stack of cards. You'll see card time. And that's the stack of cards I sat outside of my office that, well, I didn't set. The president of the company would sit. She'd stack them up there, and I'd go pick one, look at it. That's my next task. I'd just pick it up and run with it. So I had more time and more flexibility. And what happened is my productivity dramatically increased. Throughput, if you will, dramatically increased. I'm going to talk about this in depth at 1 o'clock when we talk about Kanban and why that's so important. But this was a company that I was at, and it was so interesting because this was a quote when I was doing an assessment of their processes. One guy said, "Our organization is structured to get 100% utilization, not 100% productivity." And it was true. It was so true. they ended up with a massive amount of time that was spent switching between projects that you're working on. Because how they planned for things is they said, well, we've got this amount of work that we need to get done. And we think we can get this much done. What are all the estimates? They went out and filled everyone's calendar, and then they discovered, you know what? The database people have an extra 150 hours this week. Let's start a new project. And they'd plug in new projects. They had so many projects in process that they ended up not being able to deliver an 8-month project. They were in their 3.5 years into their 8-month project when I got there, just about to get the plan done. Some metrics. This is just a pile of metrics. I'm not going to say these are either good or bad. These are just what people have measured in the past. These are some defect metrics. Bugs per KNCSS. What is that? Some of you metric folks would know that, run into that. That's thousands of non-commented source statements. Lines of code, right? Function points, user story, bugs per user story. These are metrics. Mean time to repair. How long after you get a bug does it take to get that back? Average reported defects per day. Some of these are important, some of them not so much. Number of system crashes, compile failures. Project metrics. These are some metrics that are used in projects. Schedule estimation accuracy. What does that mean? You lay out a big old project plan, and you see, did I adhere to the project plan? I've got a project that's going to take a year to build my software. I broke it down into all these little tasks. I've stuffed them all together, and now I'm going to lay it out and say, yes, a year later, we hit it on time, on budget, on scope, and we delivered that project. 100% estimation accuracy on your schedule. Who's actually done that? I don't know. I've never heard of anybody actually doing it. With that, by the way, if I ever go into a company and they tell me, oh, we nailed it. We had a plan a year ago, and we built this software, and we delivered exactly that software, usually my response is, tell me more, because I bet they did not deliver the best software they could. When you plan a year out, unfortunately, there's a lot of things you don't know. There could be a feature in there that takes a month to build that you think is going to be worth $50 to 10% of your users, and it ends up being worth $5 to 1% of your users. Do you still want to take that time to build it? Probably not. So if your schedule isn't constantly changing, you might have problems. So I'm not a big fan of that one. But it's in there. Effort estimation accuracy. Percent overtime. Utilization rate. We talked about that. Cost per 1,000 lines of code. Earned value. Who here works for the government? Do you guys use earned value? Yes, right? If you work for the government, you work for the military, you work for big places, earned value. It's how much you've completed versus how much you had committed to. So in other words, if you've completed half the work and you're halfway through the project, boom, you're on it. That's a metric that forces bad behaviors. Let me sketch out a project plan for you. I'm just going to do it in my hands here. If I go out and have a project and I lay it out, it's a Microsoft project plan. I have a critical path that runs through it. What happens if I'm on the critical path but I'm blocked? It's really, 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 really hard. What do I do in order for my earned value metrics not to look bad? I go work on something that's not on the critical path so I can get something done. So I can be 99% done with my plan. I mean, 99% done with my work at 99% of the time, but not be anywhere near delivery because the critical path hasn't been done. And it steers people away from doing the right things. So I had a little rant. I had to rant on that one a little bit. Code metrics, things that sit down a little bit lower, things like complexity, code coverage over your tests, code churn over time. All these things provide some pretty decent data. Size, sizing's hard. Story points, I wrote user stories, I didn't mean to. Story points in that? Oh, it could be size of the whole application. in user stories. Does anybody here use function points? They are brutal hard. We've got one. There, you almost have to be really, you go through the training process and all that other stuff to do them effectively. Reliability metrics are another one. Mean time to failure, MTTF, right? When you buy a hard drive, you always check on that. Number of failures per N hours of operation. What's the probability that you can run that thing for a week and not have any failures at all? I love this one. Number of undiscovered bugs released to production. Does anybody measure that? The reason I think that one's interesting is you can measure it. Here's how. There's two ways that people measure the number of bugs that were released to production. The first way uses Bayesian statistics. I'm not going to go into that. It's a little bit more complicated. But I can explain very briefly the second way. And I'm going to do it through an analogy. It's how the fish and game folks measure the number of fish inside of a lake. How you measure the number of fish in a lake, you don't just dynamite the entire lake, right, and then count them. You've got to do something different. So what you do is you catch 1,000 fish, and you tag 1,000 fish, and you dump them back in the water. You've got 1,000 fish that are caught. You wait a week or so, let them kind of filter throughout the rest of the lake, and you catch another 1,000 fish, and you count how many were tagged. If 1,000 of the fish you caught the first time were tagged, and 1,000 of the fish you caught the second time were tagged, chances are there's only 1,000 fish in the lake. But if you catch 100 fish that were tagged out of those 1,000, what does that mean? You've got a range that you can be fairly confident that there's somewhere around 10,000 fish in there, give or take 9,000. I mean, it's a pretty wide spectrum here. What's interesting about that is you can do that with bugs. How many of you have filed a Kinect bug at Microsoft? Just a few. You go to connect.microsoft.com, here's a bug. Boom, and you tell them what that bug is. Microsoft doesn't do this, but they should. When you hit connect and file a bug, it's a brand new bug. They could look at it. Is it a duplicate? The number of duplicates they get versus the number of fresh bugs they get could give them the number of bugs that were released into production that they can expect from the quality. You can measure more things than you think you can measure. And that's why I wanted to stress that. I threw that one up there because how the heck do you get that data? But you can do it. If you have two independent test teams, you can do it. There's a lot of different ways to find it, but you don't need independent test teams. Get with me afterwards. I'll talk to you on some of those. And I have a spreadsheet that helps you calculate. You can just, if you have that continuous feed that comes in, like Microsoft on the Kinect bugs and which ones are duplicates and which ones aren't, they can help estimate how many remaining open bugs there are in your application. Customer metrics. Bugs reported per users, customer calls per month, process metrics. Bug density during the testing phase, effectiveness of bug removals. All of these are metrics, but we have to decide which ones we want to measure. Measurement has a cost, and it's a high cost in a lot of cases. If you don't have something like Team Foundation Server or some other tool that's gathering data behind the scenes, it means asking developers. You just fixed a bug. What requirement did it map to? Boom. You've got a new piece of data. Right? If you can't, you have all these things that you have to capture manually. But even if you have TFS, there's still a cost to capturing these data. Here's my characteristics. You may have your own. These are mine. In order for a metric to be effective, it has to be comparable. Over time, I have to be able to say something like, are we getting better? We had 100 foos last month. We have 200 foos this month. We're getting a lot worse or a lot better. I can measure it. It's comparable over time. It doesn't mean it has to be comparable between teams. Story points are a fairly effective measure for sizing. Completely non-comparable between any two Scrum teams. Simple. it can't be overly complex. If you have to sit and think about what a metric means, it isn't effective to drive your behavior change. The reason you have metrics is so people will change their behaviors. If they can't understand the metric, they don't know what to do to change their behaviors. It has to be actionable. I just touched on this. You have to be able to say, I have a problem, I have a metric, this is how I'm going to respond to that. And it has to be honest. And by honest, I don't mean people have to tell the truth when they're reporting it. I mean that the metric needs to be aligned with your business value. If the metric is getting better, your business should be getting better, or some component of your business. If it's worse, if the metric's going up and your business isn't getting better, you may have a problem. Classic example, this is the Dilbert comic. There's Wally and he's talking to Dilbert, and they're both sipping a cup of coffee, and Dilbert says to Wally, did you hear the new policy? We get $5 for every bug we find. Wally has a little sip of coffee and says, well, time to go code me up a Winnebago. He's going to take off, and it's got to be aligned with what you're trying to do. This is the stupid, trivial example. Is this more productive because you're measuring lines of code? Everybody harasses lines of code. It's an awful measure to measure people's productivity, but it's not that bad for some things. True metrics versus proxy. When you're looking at a metric, there's two ways to look. Find out what do you want to measure. You may not be able to measure that thing. You then have a proxy measure, which is what you can measure. I want to measure customer sat. Right? That's the thing that I want to know. Every release of every iteration from my Scrum team, and they're releasing stuff to production, I want to know how happy my stakeholders are. That's really hard to measure, but we can do some things. How many thumbs up did we get? How many smiles did we see when we demoed the project? How many oohs? How many ahs? We can do an evaluation. You evaluate me as a presenter. Why? So that next year, Microsoft and whoever else is hosting the conference can determine which speakers, which topics are the most important for you. Because they can't ask all of you directly. So they use a proxy metric. That's the proxy metrics. And so let's look at a few metrics and just see where they are. Defect removal efficiency. This is kind of a fancy name for how many bugs did you catch prior to release versus how many you got the first year after your product released. You catch 500 bugs prior to release. You catch 100 bugs post-release. Divide that up. You've got, 100 or 5. You catch 100 bugs prior to release, 0 bugs after, infinite. You're perfect. Defect removal efficiency, I'm going to come back to it because there's some interesting traits that particular measure has. Code coverage, it's not always honest, though. Right? I'm doing unit testing. Everybody should be unit testing. You've heard it probably 20 times here this week. You're unit testing, and you've got 80% code coverage. It may not be the right 80%. And do you want to push it to 100? Maybe not. You got a lot of auto-generated code that's probably fine. So, something to think about. Performance profiling, not always actionable. You profile the application, and it comes right down to it, and it's a problem in IIS, and there's nothing you can do about it. Okay? May not be actionable. Test cases per feature, bugs per feature, there are things to think about. Test cases per feature. This is one that Jeff Levinson uses at one of our customers. And what kind of behavior do you think that drove?
Writing excessive cases.
Excessive test cases, exactly. A lot of test cases popped up once they knew they were being measured on it. So instead, they put kind of a bar. Once you have 3, you don't get credit for any more, basically. But sometimes you need more. So now they have a problem with that. I don't know. It's always a problem. Metrics can always be a problem. Lines of code, not always honest, right? It can be bad for your company when the lines of code go up. Maybe a better measure is lines of code going down. When you release your application, did you release it with fewer lines of code in this next release? You could argue that that's not a bad measure. It's probably not good either. Effort, not always honest or comparable. Effort is a really hard one. And we're going to come into estimation and talk about estimation. And it really grates because it's so hard. Because you ask people, how long is this going to take? And they say, 10 hours. 10 hours later, they're done. They report it. If they have four of those tasks and they work 60 hours to get them done during the week, guess how many they report? 40 hours. Because they put it in the timesheet and it's always 40. It's always 40. So you often can't get good data. We'll talk a little bit more about that too. Story points, rarely comparable between teams, but otherwise good. Velocity, throughput, lines of code per developer per day. Just wrong on so many levels. I cannot believe it, but I have run into this in the last 2 years. I've probably run into it three times, where companies are actually measuring people on lines of code per developer per day. Is there anyone here that thinks that's a good idea? Do I need to spend any time on that? It is so wrong. It is so wrong. Productivity measures, this is my favorite, quality. You think of the iron triangle, and now it's the iron, tetrahedron or whatever. But you have scope, budget, what is it?
Time,
scope, budget, and then quality. And if I sacrifice quality, I can get things out faster, right? I can break the iron triangle by sacrificing quality. No, you can't. You can this sprint, but you cannot over time. What is so interesting is that this particular study by Capers-Jones, he found that the most effective measure of a team's velocity long-term is, drumroll, defect removal efficiency. What? The better you are at not shipping bugs, the faster you deliver code. It is not the way people think of it. The higher the quality of your underlying code, the better you are to build on top of it. So you can't sacrifice quality for speed other than the very shortest terms. So don't do it. That, to me, is a very interesting metric. It's something to pay attention to. There's user metrics, number of help desk calls we've talked about, not always honest. Thanks, Anthony, for some of those coming up. And by honest, I don't mean that people are dishonest. I just mean it's not necessarily correlated correctly with the business. Business metrics, we don't need to see all these, right? ROI, estimation accuracy, rarely simple, not always honest. Those are metrics. We need to scope down now and talk about what we use in Lean and agile software development. Because the metrics in Waterfall are different than the metrics we're gonna wanna gather in Lean and Agile. There's some big overlap, but there's a dramatic shift in focus. But to do that, last year I didn't do an explanation of what Scrum and Kanban are, so I'm gonna give an overview of Scrum and Kanban. Let me know, who here knows what Scrum and Kanban both are? Okay, about half. Who here does not know what Kanban is? And not Scrum? Awesome. So Scrum we'll go through very, very quickly, spend a little bit more time on Kanban, and then we'll jump in. So what is Scrum? Scrum is a software development methodology that puts things into boxes, time boxes. 2-week sprints, 3-week sprints. And we'll talk about what those are. There are three distinct roles, and that's it. You know, so there's no business analyst in Scrum. There's no tester. They're all part of the development team. You may have testers, you just call them developers. You have several defined events, and then you have artifacts. High focus on working software at the end of every sprint. And a strong focus on definition of done to protect the quality of your code. This is what Scrum looks like. You have a big old backlog of all the things you have to build to release to a customer. You grab a small subset. You bring it into a sprint. We have a sprint planning meeting. We all sit down and we estimate in hours how long the tasks will take to implement each sprint. So we do a work breakdown structure and we assign hours to that. We then go into the sprint, 1 to 4 week sprints. In that sprint, we work and we track how many hours in each task that we actually have remaining. Not how many you've done, how many is remaining. And then every morning or afternoon, you have a stand-up, you get together and you ask three questions, normally. What did I do yesterday? What am I going to do today? And is there anything blocking me? And at the end of the sprint, you get working software. It aligns very well with the Agile Manifesto. It ties very tightly to that. In fact, it predates the Agile Manifesto by quite a few years. Metrics that we use in Scrum, two key primary metrics. You've got a burn down, where you're measuring the amount of work left, and you've got a velocity metric, where you're measuring how fast you're working sprint over sprint over sprint. Kanban is a little different animal. In Kanban, here's the basics. There's five basics. And it's not very declarative. It doesn't tell you exactly what you need to do. It only gives you kind of hints. There are five principles, however. Visualize your work. Put it on a big old board somewhere where everyone can see it. Make your policies explicit, very similar to the Scrum's definition of done. Limit your work in process or work in progress. Don't try to do too many things at the same time. And focus on flow. Watch that board. Watch things flow across the board and focus on nice, smooth flow across that board. And then you commit to continuous improvement. Here's the canonical Kanban board. First, they visualized it. This next analysis, development, acceptance, prod, this is not everyone's Kanban board. These are not the states you do. This is just some development teams starting where they were, said, this is how we work. Okay, and they plop it up there. So visualize all your work. It's all plugged up there. You realize immediately that you're doing too much stuff at the same time, and you need to reduce the amount you're working on in order to get flow. Okay? So you impose work in progress limits. Well, first you do the definition of done, right? Make your policies explicit. So in order to get out of development, I need to be checked in on the trunk, and I need to have this thing fully tested and a couple other things, right? Then you limit your work in process. This is the interesting thing. If you look up here in analysis, you'll see there can only be three cards. If you look at dev, there can only be three cards in all of dev. What happens if all the developers finish and all three cards are sitting in done? What do the developers do if they're doing pure Kanban? They go do something else. I will argue, and I'll argue this at my 1 o'clock presentation that's purely on Kanban, it's an introduction to Kanban, that it's better that they just sit on their butts and don't do anything. But it's better that they go play ping pong than to start and pick up new work. But that's what Kanban does. That's how it limits its work in process. And then you focus on flow, things flowing through. Cards tell a story. And Kanban aligns with the lean principles. Like Scrum aligns with Agile, Kanban aligns with the lean principles. Eliminating waste, respecting people, delivering fast, optimizing the whole, not optimizing just a small portion of that. It also is measurable. You have two primary key metrics in Kanban. That's the measurement of the amount of work in process you have, as well as your lead time. On average, how long does it take you to get something to the customer? What's the difference? In order to understand them, I'm going to kind of tie Kanban to Scrum a little bit. I'm sorry for such a short overview, but it's one of those things that you just need a little foundation to understand why the metrics are different. Not between them, but why Kanban and Scrum need different metrics than the bigger software development as a whole uses. So what's the difference between them? Scrum is very structured. If you want to know how to do Scrum, you pick up a book, and there are guidance on how to do Scrum. Kanban, very unstructured. You start where you are and improve over time incrementally. Kanban, or Scrum, is time-boxed. You have a two-week iteration or a one-week iteration. You commit to work. You estimate how much work can be done in a sprint. You say, yes, we'll try to get that much done. You do your sprint, and at the end of the sprint, you meet with your stakeholders and you show them what you've done. Kanban, you can do that. It's very flexible. In practice, most Kanban teams are continuous flow, meaning they'll start a user story and it goes right into production. It's got everything it needs to go into production one at a time. They just kind of flow things across. They may queue them up for release or whatnot, but in Scrum, you have those three defined roles. Kanban has none. This is key in Scrum. Scrum limits the amount of work you do by limiting it to the state. I mean, by limiting it to the sprint. Your sprint is 4 weeks long. You can accomplish only 4 weeks worth of stuff, and that's all you try to accomplish. In Kanban, we also limit the work in process there, but we do it in states. So each state limits it. In Scrum, there is no prescribed process. I mean, in Kanban. In Kanban, you have these rituals that you accomplish. You go through a planning ritual. You go through a ceremony, you could call it. You go through a planning ceremony where you plan what you're going to do the next sprint, where you break down the work and do estimates. And think about it, right? This is your chance to sit and understand the complexity of what you're about to embark on in Scrum. That's one of its real strong strengths. Kanban doesn't have any prescribed things there. When am I going to be done? Does anybody here have to estimate when you're going to be done? That means about half of you do not have to estimate. Is that right? How many of you do not have to estimate when you're going to be done? Just one. Oh, awesome. Just one. That was a binary question, by the way, so I can tell who didn't drink all their coffee this morning. In Kanban, traditionally, you do it by measuring your average lead time. You know, if your average time to build a user story is 19 days, and you've got 400 user stories, you just multiply it out. In Scrum, the defined roles, Kanban can have specialists. Scrum, you limit by sprint. Kanban, you limit by state. You measure velocity in Scrum, cycle time in Kanban. Your sprint backlog is locked in Scrum. It protects the development team from churn. But it limits some of the flexibility of the business. In Kanban, instead, you have a ready queue. It's the queue that you're going to start from, your backlog, if you will. But it's a smallish backlog. And at any time, the business can swap things in and out of there, 100 times a day if they want. Once you've started one, you generally don't get disrupted, however. This is what a Scrum board looks like. At the beginning of the sprint, you've got all your user stories. Chunk, 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 chunk. At the end of the sprint, they're all in the done column. In Kanban, it's the same board every single day. That sounds boring, and it sounds problematic. Both of those provide one of the most crucial metrics for your development practice. If you're in Scrum and you're watching those things flow across, the metric is, how well is my sprint running? And I will assert you get a better idea of how well your sprint is going by looking at that board than you do by looking at the burndown chart. Because the burndown chart suffers from the earned value problem, right? People can work on the easy stuff first. Kanban does not give you that. It provides an entirely different metric. And the metric is a story told by each card. As each card is flowing across, you'll find that it kind of develops a personality of its own, a story that it tells. at Northwest Cadence, we have gold stars that we put on customers that it went really spectacularly well with or we really liked dealing with. We also have Mr. Yuck stickers. They're not for bad customers. They're just for where something went horribly wrong, right? So Scrum, prioritization, Kanban, you can do whatever you want. They both have stand-ups. You focus on work. What did I do yesterday? What am I doing today? What am I blocked on? That's too big of a number of people for a Scrum team. Kanban tends to focus on the board and look at the flow, which is a metric. And the two metrics we already talked about. There's your key differences. Fast walkthrough. Does everyone feel like they have a kind of an understanding of Kanban? It's measures of value that flow across the board in a card. If you want to dive into why that is so different from Scrum and why it's so powerful, we talk about that at one. Here's some metrics for Scrum. There's more that you capture. The bolded ones are the ones that are official metrics. Some of the others are just as important, however. One thing people get good at in Scrum is estimation, because they're asked to estimate how long it's going to take them to do particular tasks, and they actually assign hours to those. Capers Jones did a big study on this. The only way to get good at estimation is to estimate. You take your senior developer who just knows the technology in and out, and a guy just out of college, guess what? They're going to be about as good at estimating how long things will take. Unless one of them has done a bunch of estimation. It's the only way to get good at things. Accuracy of sprint commitments. You're committing to a certain number of stories, and then did you finish them? Yes, a question. I love this, right? This is I'm going to rephrase this. The question was, I've met with Scrum teams who, you know, their accuracy of sprint commitment is off, but you never know it because they work 24 hours a day on the day before the sprint ends. You know, they just go crazy. It's, right? It's the death march, only it happens to be 2 days of death march as opposed to a long one. That's why I threw another metric on here, developer burnout. I don't know how to measure it yet. Maybe it's measured, a proxy metric for that is overtime. Most devs don't get paid overtime, but you need to track something like that because Scrum can suffer from that. You're getting to the end and you really want to make your commitments. I'll just stay a couple extra hours. I'll just debug this one last thing before I go home. So it is something that you need to be concerned about. Thanks for that question. Did that answer? Metrics from Kanban. Kanban measures two things. How much work you're working on, your WIP. We'll call it WIP. Work in process or work in progress. It's the things you're working on. And then what's called the lead time, from when you start to when you're done. And they also measure something called cycle time. And there's a really fine difference between lead time and cycle time. Cycle time is when I get it and I can start it and I'm responsible for it. It's in my domain and I get it through and it leaves my domain. That's my cycle time. Lead time is when did the thing get requested? Like when was the bug filed and it starts clock ticking? That's your lead time through the system. My cycle time as a developer is when I opened up the bug and I started fixing it. That's my developer cycle time. It's kind of, I don't know. Measure throughput. A big thing in Kanban is you measure failure demand. Failure demand is how much work do I have to do, you can measure it in Scrum too, that is not work I planned on because I blew it. I shipped cruddy code, and what came back were bugs, and now I have to fix bugs. So your percentage of failure demand to value demand is kind of a metric you can measure and you can use. That's also very similar to the bugs that escape metric. Yeah, question.
Do you put the bugs, failures, as another user story in Kanban?
So in the Kanban board, you put a failure back as a new thing that flows through the board? Yes, if it escaped. If QA finds it, very often they just move the card back. But it depends. Yes, you have to tag it as a failure demand. Normally, if you're calculating that metric a lot, what you do is you have a new card that flows through, because then you have the overall throughput for that card as well, or cycle time. And that's your failure demand. Question in the back.
You say a work in process.
What is the unit of measurement for work in process? It depends. Yep. So I could have one task, someone could have five, but it could be the same amount of work. A work in process, the reason I say depends, it depends on the level you are at in the organization. A lot of times teams, a development team, will limit the amount of user stories they're working on. An individual may limit the number of tasks they're working on. You step up one level in the organization, the project management office may limit the amount of projects that are going on. And above that, the C-level executives may be limiting the amount of corporate-wide initiatives they're pushing. So it kind of depends. The granularity really does depend. It depends on how you break down your process. If you're flowing user stories now, very often Kanban teams don't flow tasks at all. One more question before I head off to the next topic. I like the way he put that. And the way he put that is what we tend to flow in manufacturing, where Kanban came from, is a flow of value. Things that happen. There's a flow of value. And we want to measure something that has value. And that's why in Kanban, very often, people flow user stories. But if you came to Kanban from Scrum, a lot of people still flow tasks. So it could be. So let's talk a little bit more. Lean and Agile metrics are very, very simple. We're not measuring all this craziness. We're measuring something so incredibly simple. I mean, really. How many user stories you're working on? How hard is that? I mean, you just walk up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I've got 5. The metrics in both Scrum and Kanban are painfully simple. And yet they seem to work. Why? Because they're simple. That's one reason they're simple. Another reason is I think we've been making a lot of mistakes in software process in our industry. We focus on the iron triangle. I want to deliver on time, on budget, on scope. What do customers care about? It works, results. I got what I needed, and I got what I needed quickly. Those don't necessarily correlate. The metrics we gather are to protect against technical risk. We want to estimate so we can hit on time. We want to estimate so we can be sure we're not overspending. We have all these metrics that we gather to solve the technical risks that we face as dev organizations. Scrum and Kanban and Lean and Agile have shifted the focus to say what we want is extraordinarily fast feedback from our customers. Give me feedback. Give me something I can take that's actionable. And then I'll go into the next iteration, and I might build something completely different than I thought I did, than I thought I was going to. Steve McConnell, did a study, and he said that of a product's overall risk, 90% of the risk is market risk, meaning your customers aren't going to like it. And only 10% of the risk of a whole product that we're shipping is, are we going to ship it on time? Is it going to be on budget? Yet, in process, we often spend 90% of our effort gathering metrics that impact that 10%, And we kind of just leave it and don't spend the time on the big bucket things. Lean and agile focus on very, very fast feedback to solve the bigger problem. Doesn't mean you're going to be right. Business still needs to be in it. I just read a 12-year agile retrospective from a guy that has been in agile 12 years. And he talks about his first company, the transition from waterfall to agile, and how that team was just clicking until they went bankrupt. Brilliant transition, totally focused team, but they weren't building the right thing, and they were isolated from the marketplace. So feedback's king. Yes? Have I transitioned from companies who've gone from RUP to Agile? Yes, a lot. RUP is not waterfall. It's not meant to be waterfall. It's meant to be highly iterative. But there are some rules in it that incent people to turn it into big waterfall-y processes. And yes, people make that transition. Quite often, it's a painful transition. But if you're doing RUP in the highly iterative fashion, it's usually not too bad. Kind of depends on the team. Yes?
So in the RUP, there is a definite description of what architecture needs to be and design needs to be, right? Use cases, culture, sequence diagrams, all of those things. But EDGA doesn't have any of that. So what happens to the documentation about which the developers are not?
So the question was, in RUP, I've got all these things that are laid out for me, right? I've got, this is how to do documentation, how to do use cases, and Agile's got none of that. How do people make that transition? There's a mistake, there's one mistake, which is Agile doesn't have any of that. It has it only if needed to deliver software. In other words, if you need to have an architecture diagram to successfully deliver software, you will create that architecture diagram, maybe even create it up front in a kind of very waterfall-y method. Chances are you'll build a smaller architecture and then grow it over time. That transition, though, still is difficult because you do shed things that people haven't used before. And sometimes you shed things that are important. I'm going to give you one example. A lot of times in RUP or where you have a formal process where you're doing a lot of the architectural work up front, you're thinking through some very difficult problems early. Sometimes when you're in Agile, you forget to think about the big picture until you're down a road that might be pretty difficult to move from. That's where that balance needs to take place. You need to strike that balance. Now, if you're building websites, and you're going very rapidly out on websites, that's kind of a market that has just adopted the Agile because you can really change your architecture quickly. I mean, look at Twitter, right? They built on Ruby on Rails. They knew Ruby on Rails was not going to scale for them when they built Twitter. But they could crank out new versions of it almost immediately, just bang, 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 and get to where people were using it, and then it was crashing all the time. Architecturally, bad call. They rewrote the whole thing in a functional program. Functional programming language. I just forgot the name of it. Erlang, I think. Right? So they could get that scale. But they did that afterwards. Because they could get what was most important, and that was the feedback from their users. One metric. I say this almost tongue-in-cheek, a little bit. I don't think there's one perfect metric. But it's the metric that lately I've been using more and more and more and more, and that's time to feedback. How long until I can get feedback from someone or something about what I'm working on? A lot of times this is lead time or cycle time, and it scales all the way through, up and down. So for example, for a developer, I'm writing some code. How long until I get feedback on whether that code works? I want to be compiling all the time. I want to be running unit tests all the time. I want to get feedback multiple times an hour, probably multiple times a minute if I'm moving fast enough. Time to feedback for developers again. check in their code. We run a suite of automated regression tests, maybe user interface tests. How fast can I get feedback from that? As a dev team, how fast can I get feedback from my customers? How fast can I get it to them and get feedback? And the reason that I'm focusing so much on this lately is because metrics have consequences that are negative at times. Right? You measure something, and then people start to follow it. What is it? Goodhart's law? Once a measure becomes a goal, it ceases to be a good metric. I don't see as many weaknesses in time to feedback. Here's the interesting thing. It's a feedback loop, right? You have your constant feedback loop. I build something, I measure it, I get some kind of feedback, and I adjust my behavior accordingly. I jump in, I measure something else, get feedback, adjust my behavior. Very fast learning cycle or learning loop. If you throw a time blocker into that, you run into problems. You all know this, right? In fact, you're probably, it depends on where you're staying. In my hotel that I'm staying at, the water doesn't adjust very quickly. So first time I'm in the shower, I turn it on. Brr, it's cold. Turn it a little warmer. Man, it's still cold. Turn it a little warmer. That's about right. I hop in and still a little cold. Turn it up a little bit more. And then all of a sudden, that thing is so hot, I'm out of the shower. I'm out of here. It was that delayed feedback that didn't let me adjust fast enough. And then I turn it down, and I run into the same problem, this wild oscillation back between the two. I mean, we're smart, and we overcome it. But that wild oscillation occurs because that feedback does not come fast enough. If you are spending 6 months before your customer sees your software, you're not getting feedback fast enough. You're not targeting what they need. You're not getting there fast enough. There's five steps to any process. You have to pay not just attention to the run state, but to the whole thing. How long have things been sitting into queues? How long did you take to set up for it, to run, to move? Slow feedback is a killer. It's a killer across the board. At Microsoft, they've said that if a bug, a high priority, non-security bug, gets sent back to a tester because a developer can't repro it, it will be 40 hours of work time before that bug gets back into the developer's queue to work on. It's a big deal. Here's how do you decrease lead time? How do you get that feedback faster? This is a very simple diagram. It's called a cumulative flow. And you have the amount of work, and you have time. And you start off not doing anything, right? And you get to assign some work. Then over time, you get assigned more and more and more and more work. After a period of time, you complete some work. And then you complete more and more and more and more work. What's inside of this is your work in process. And at any given date, you can say, you can measure, this is how much stuff I'm working on. From that, you can say, here's my average lead time. This is how long it's going to take me, on average, to get this to you. Let's put numbers. Let's say we've got 6 items in there, right there. And now the executives come in, and they've heard this talk, and they say, thou shalt no longer work on 6 items. If you work on 6 items, you're fired. You must work on 3 at most. We're going to limit WIP. What happens to lead time? What happens? It goes down. Lead time goes down. You get faster lead time. You don't have to buy really fancy tools so that your developers can bend that curve up. I mean, that helps too. All you have to do is cut the amount of stuff you're working on. To deliver more frequently, reduce work in process. This is called Little's Law, and here's our 2 minutes of math. That slope is the delivery rate. I'm going to treat it as fixed, that we can't deliver any faster because we, you know, now that you've come here to Tech Ed, you might go back with new ideas and be able to deliver faster. But let's assume you can't. What happens, this is Little's Law, that little triangle, and the delivery rate equals work in progress divided by lead time. So lead time is work in progress divided by delivery rate. Why do we care? Here's why. WIP is a leading metric for lead time. Leading metrics have substantially more value in any field than do lagging metrics. If you can look ahead, you get far more benefits than yesterday's weather. This is looking ahead. If I see my WIP gradually growing, I'm going to know that my lead time is going to go down, and I'm going to get much less feedback from my customers. In Scrum, how do you limit WIP? You shrink your iterations. Manage queues. They're a leading indicator. Yes? What was that? Question is, how do you collect lead time for that? When something, you start working on something, and when it's completely done. So it depends what you're measuring it for. Lead time for a bug would be when did somebody submit the bug to the time you are now done delivering that bug. You may choose, because you may not have control over the backlog, when did you start working on it as a team to when it was delivered into production. That may be a better metric to use, because you have more control over it. One more question on that. User stories, how would you measure it? It would be the same way. When did you start working on the user story? For Scrum, when did the sprint begin? When did the sprint end? For Scrum, it's real easy. It's 2 weeks. Your lead time is always 2 weeks if you're doing two-week sprints. You want to reduce your lead time, you reduce the work in process to a 1 week. Scrum does it kind of the opposite. Kanban will squeeze work in progress to get a limited lead time, or Kanban, and Scrum shortens the amount of lead time and then sees how much work you have remaining, and then you fill it with that. Same thing, two different approaches. I'm going to come back to that question in just a moment. Let me do a quick case study. This was a company that, this was their flow, this was their process. These were states where they had to wait for people. They had a lot of buildup of work in process. These states, the design phase, these are where people are working on those states. You see we have working on 19, waiting on 31 for sign-offs. This is a very waterfall company. What happens was they would dump, they'd get together for an approval and dump all the stuff into the coding queue, causing this big back and forth, this big flow back and just this big bump in what you're working on. They went from 19 in this example to 38 items. And now they have 38 people calling them, hey, when are you going to be done with my project? In order to slow them down, this was on a big wall. In order to slow them down, in order to speed them up, we needed to reduce the amount of things that were floating around in there. Specifically, reduce the things that people were waiting on for sign-off. So we put this little thing in here. Cost of delay for all stories waiting for sign-off. Because they weren't on our team. Cumulative, the $63,000. This week, $21,000. That's how much it cost the company for that person doing sign-off to wait on it. I cover this in a little more detail at the 1 o'clock talk. But it's a metric that we gathered, which was along the lines of cost of delay. It's a cost of delay metric, and we just exposed it. What do you think that happened? What do you think happened? Man, it slimmed down. In fact, the design people came to us and said, "Can you tell me how to set up alerts in TFS? I want to know so I can sign off on this." I don't know if that's the right behavior. Maybe now they don't ever look at things and they just sign off on things without ever paying attention. I don't know. But I limited my WIP and got substantial benefits in throughput. As an example, here's just some examples on the lead time to complete tasks goes down. Quality went way up. That's the unexpected behavior, is that it drives up quality when you reduce work in process. In fact, it drives up every good metric around your organization. It's amazing. Now, some questions, and I had one demo I wanted to do, but I will take a couple questions first before I jump into a demo. That question right back there, because you were waiting. How How do you baseline your process so you can start to measure improvements with Kanban? I'm going to defer that to the Kanban talk, if I can. And I know you may not be able to make it at one. You can come up afterwards. I want to kind of more focus on some of the metrics. My apologies. Question? Yes. Yes, are there any reporting tools that pull from TFS and report all of this? Yes, you don't want to design from scratch. Hakon Force built a tool called Visual Whip. Visual Whip, and it's free. You can get it on CodePlex. There's also another Kanban tool called Eileen, which is also pretty good, E-Y-L-E-A-N. Just one second. I want to flip over really briefly to do a demo of an estimation worksheet, if you happen to have. In this example, we've gathered real data on how long things took, right? If you're Scrum and you're in TFS, you can kind of figure out how long things took to build in hours for tasks. We've rolled them up to these requirements. And this is just a pull from TFS. It's an old pull. But you can see here, closed for requirement one, we estimated it would take us 5 hours, but actually it took us 5 hours. On requirement seven, estimated 4 hours. It actually took five. We did that for small, medium, and large, and then we just simply calculated, based on the historical data, the standard deviation and the mean. This is just data that you can pull from TFS. If you have TFS and you've been using it, you can get this data. Go out and grab it, even if you're not measuring hours. I'll tell you that in just a moment. So here we have the standard deviation and the mean for each of those small, medium, and large. Ignore the math. We go into here and we say, what is our backlog? What are our proposed requirements? And are they small, medium, or large? And then over here, I have a column that says estimated work. And I'm just going to play a game. I'm going to pick a random number in that small distribution. In order to do this small, it's going to take 8.45 hours. Okay? And then I'm going to play that game again and again and again. I'm going to play it. Let's play it 300 times. Okay, this is called a Monte Carlo simulation. And all we're going to do is we're just going to take that and run it 300 times. What I'm doing is I'm simulating running an entire software development practice based off historical data. And then what I do is I come and I can lay out an estimate of how long it's going to take me at what confidence intervals. So if I scroll down here, I can see that if I'm going to try to deliver on August 11th of 2009, I have a 1.25% probability of delivering on time. If that's when the trade show is, I'm screwed. Scroll across, and I have a pretty high confidence that I can deliver by August 27th, however. We mined this data out of a real company. And what was amazing is how much more accurate their estimates were when they were based off of historical metrics, historical data. We were able to get plus or minus 10% on their estimates as opposed to plus or minus 30 to 35%, which is where they were hitting before. What's more is that you'll see is just t-shirt sizes. So the estimates weren't work breakdown structure. We have all these requirements. We break them down into a bunch of little stuff, and then we roll up the numbers. We didn't do that anymore. Instead, we simply said, is this requirement small, medium, or large? It's the small. You only read the title. Yeah, it's a small. And we reduced the amount of time it took in the teams to do their initial estimates from 2 weeks to an afternoon. And more accurate. There's some really interesting things. Once they had that accurate estimation, that's a metric, right? So they had this really accurate estimation ability, but then they said, well, now we don't have to record hours anymore. So they stopped recording actuals. Well, now we're starting to drift away, right? Because the teams have evolved, they've added people, et cetera. I'm going to switch back to PowerPoint real briefly to wrap. Any last questions? There was a question back there I wanted to catch first, if they haven't stepped out. Yes. Yes. So in Kanban, I said you might be working on two items at a time. Does that depend on the size of the team? Oh, absolutely. A team of 30 would work on less. Would work on more. That you'll have to wait. Two items per person, two items per team. It all depends. I'll talk more about that on the Kanban presentation. Bottom line, as I wrap up, metrics are critical because they drive people's behaviors. What you show management and what they can measure will be how they measure you and how they make decisions. Try to choose the metrics that aren't going to cause unintended consequences. Pick really good metrics. And again, I'll just kind of finish up with the metric that I think has the least unintended consequences is that time to feedback. How fast can I look and say, I want feedback from somebody, from the marketplace? Thank you all for attending. If you would, thank you so much. Please fill out your evaluations. It's how we live and die by them. I'd really appreciate if you take the time to fill those out. Thank you so much.